Hello everyone, welcome to Chats Over Coffee with my yoga teacher. It's a podcast with me, Peter Brush, the comedian, and I talk to my yoga teacher in this podcast, who is called Kayla. Hi Kayla.
Hi Peter. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure, as always. Right, if you're not listening to this before, we talk about not just yoga, but like the body and the mind, science sometimes, and stuff. So don't be put off. Don't turn off yet. Give us at least 5 minutes before you decide whether it's rubbish. But if you're listening in real time, when this actually drops, as the kids say.
Do the kids say that?
The kids probably used to say that.
Okay.
They probably don't say it now. What do the kids say? They say Riz. They say that you got the Riz. I've heard that. But they probably don't say that now either.
No, probably not.
Anyway, if you're listening in when this actually drops, it's May 2024. But you can be listening whenever. If you are listening now, though, we're just about to tell you what we're doing this month, just in case, because we're essential for interaction, isn't it? So
absolutely.
So yeah, that's a very messy way around of saying what are you doing this month.
What am I doing this month? I am taking a little bit of a step back at the end of April and beginning of May, but if you're interested in joining classes, I do have things in the works. So I would say to those people who are interested in yoga and anatomy of yoga and delving into that kind of stuff to go to my website, kaylamccormack.com, and sign up for my newsletter, because that's going to be the best place to actually find out what's going on and when I launch things and stuff like that. And obviously, as a yoga teacher, I do have normal yoga teacher offerings. You can buy classes from me, you can buy one-off events for your work, and the usual kind of things like that. So, you know, if you're interested in anything like that, just reach out, send me a message. I don't have loads of admin. It is me. I will respond. I'm not that big, so feel free to.
Well, it depends when you're listening to this, doesn't it? So it could be a few years time.
Hopefully by 2030, I do have a virtual assistant. We'll see.
Your team will deal with all inquiries.
What about you? What have you got going on in May?
I am performing across the United Kingdom and just doing regular club spots as I usually am. But I've got a couple of gigs for the RAF, our brave boys.
Can we say boys and girls? Or
and girls? Shit, of course, yeah. Okay. Sorry, yeah. I've seen Top Gun Maverick. Women can fly planes as well. I haven't actually seen that, but I know that there's a woman pilot in that.
Mm.
Yes, sorry. So, yeah, just, I don't know, like, I do list all my gigs, which is on my website, which I put in the show description, as well as Kayla's website. So mine's peterbrushcomedy.com, but I would follow us both on social media as well, like Instagram, which I'll put links to as well. And so yeah, I just gig in really, but I'm on the internet. Shall we start the show?
Yes, enjoy.
So, you know, the internet makes people go down these rabbit holes, they sort of believe weird stuff, because this is a problem with not being able to verify anything.
Yeah.
So do you know the actress and singer Eartha Kitt? She sang Santa Baby, a famous version of that.
Yeah, I think
so. She was also, I think, the original Catwoman.
Yeah.
My friend of mine has found this conspiracy theory about her, right? So apparently there's a theory that she stuffed her bra, right?
Yeah.
So my friend believes this, right, because he's a flat earther conspiracist. Yeah, okay. sorry. Anyway.
Oh, okay.
We should probably talk about something. So talk about the hips.
Yeah, we can talk about hips.
We might have done it before, because I recognised you saying the thing about holding emotions in them, but I couldn't find an episode where I'd written that down in any of the descriptions.
Oh, okay.
But you could just say stuff, and then, because I feel like I wanted to take objection to something, maybe. But I'm not sure. Okay. I do. I'm not sure. It depends what you say.
Because, well, yeah, tell me what to say so you can take objection. Is this what you heard in my class then? In my hips class?
No. Oh, okay. Not really. It is kind of to do with the hips holding emotions, though. A little bit. Like, okay. I'm not entirely sure how you're going to back that up scientifically.
Okay. I suppose on that side of things, on the whole side of, like, if you're quite regular in the yoga community, you'll definitely come across people who say, like, oh, if I do a hip-oriented class or a hip-focused yin class, so, like, you're holding poses for a long time and stuff, that it can make people cry and it can bring up a lot of emotions. So, like, on that side of things, when we're talking about the hips, I think that there's a little bit of maybe people are expecting it. A little bit of maybe they're finally letting go of their stress. If they're in a relaxing class or they're trying to let go, maybe that would have happened in any yin class, and they're just blaming it on the hips. But I also think, like, we know for a fact that when we have emotions, those emotions are caused by chemicals in the body.
Hormones or...
Yeah, mostly hormones, I suppose. But, you know, like, we know stress, cortisol, you know, we know these are chemicals that are floating around the body that then make us react in a certain way. So if you are in your, like, super anxious fight or flight, if you fear for your life, genuinely, you're going to feel different. It's physically going to change your limbs and your fingers. Blood's going to pump faster. Things are going to change in the body. That happens as a result of a chemical being released, telling the body to change. So those chemicals can be stored in tissue in the body. So they can be stored in muscle. So when you do a movement that is something you don't normally do, little tiny fibers are broken and those chemicals can be released. So you can feel something you felt before again, but not really know the cause. So that's why they might say, like, oh, I've done a deep yin class, I'm having them crying uncontrollably, I don't know why.
Right.
Just give me a box of tissues. There's a little bit of science behind that. Whether it's enough to make you absolutely bawl, or whether it's just a little bit and you probably shouldn't notice it or you shouldn't feel it, I wouldn't be able to say. Obviously, I'm not like a biochemist.
It sort of could be like you feel a little bit that way and it's a prompt to release.
Yeah,
Especially in Britain, we're very repressed people, obviously, so we probably we probably need those things every so often.
Exactly.
Okay, well, that maybe sounds a little bit more feasible.
Mm.
Anyway, I say that partly is because maybe we should talk about the anatomy of the hips later if you want to do that. But in terms of storing stuff in your body, I've listened to a podcast series recently on the recovered memory syndrome stuff that happened in like the 90s, the sexual abuse thing. Do you know about that?
I don't think I know about this.
It's sort of been memory hold itself, really. But there was some sort of like movements, maybe the wrong term. There was a spate of people thinking that they had repressed memories of being sexually abused.
And they hadn't?
No.
Oh.
But the psychologists or the psychotherapist or whoever was...
Mm.
Like, so they'd got into their heads the idea that you could repress these memories of these things happening. Like maybe they happened like when you were like two or something like that.
Yeah.
And so symptoms of this repression were being manifested elsewhere in people's distress. And so it kind of became this popular form the term idioms of distress, where like there's a popular diagnosis for like a general distress gets kind of funneled into one's more specific diagnosis that's kind of more zeitgeisty at the time. So there was an idea, this is mainly in America, and might have been over here a little bit, but because it was like before the internet, it's not so documented, and also there's reasons why people don't want to especially remember it, because people were implicated in like because people went to prison for like sexual assault that they never did. I don't know how prevalent, maybe that's just a few examples, but you know people thinking that a relative had done something that they'd never done and stuff. So this branch of therapists sort of thought that these distressing signs were a symptom of people having repressed memories of sexual assault that had happened before they were able to remember them. And, you know, they just became convinced, the patient and clinicians and stuff became convinced that this was an actual thing. And some of it comes from Freud's ideas of like repressing memories causes a trauma later on down the pathway of someone's life. And so the whole point of having Freudian psychotherapy or whatever is to like relive all these traumas that you had, and then that somehow causes some resolution or resolves something. What I was listening to is suggestive of the fact that that isn't necessarily borne out in good science. It's just basically Freud kind of freestyling, thinking like apparently he did a lot of that.
Yeah,
it's kind of weird to me, because when I was younger and I first found out about Freud, and I was sort of like, wow, this guy is a genius, and it's just like completely changed the way that you think about like how the conscious and the subconscious work.
I'm not saying he wasn't clever and he didn't
articulate
that well, but there were some theories that he just took too far or was too blunt, you know, just assumed, I don't know. Yeah, there was quite a lot of the things that have got him popular.
He's freestyled a bit,
basically. We're not really based on science.
But, you know, like, you could say Isaac Newton was a genius, but he was also an alchemist, wasn't he? So,
Alchemy is based around the fact that they think there was an ether instead of an atmosphere, something that we couldn't see. And then that, they imagined that they could, I don't know, it was a bit of an odd idea, but, like, everyone thought it. Anyway, go on.
So basically, I've probably not done that justice, especially, but I would recommend listening to the Memory Hole podcast. It goes into the craze, and then it sort of died away, and people don't really want to remember it because, like, therapists got implicated in, but they just thought they were doing the right thing.
Did they find out what the reason was then? Was it the fact that we store chemicals in the body and stuff like that?
So this is what I was getting to. There's apparently a very influential book. I can't remember the author. I don't know whether it was used in dispositions or just used to back up a lot of this. It's a famous book apparently called It Is Written in the Body or something, I think it's called. And that is about how trauma and stuff can actually be manifested in bodily, sort of like in parts of your body. So from what I hear, it's actually based on pretty bad science, but obviously I can't counteract it personally or anything.
Yeah,
but for some reason this was like a Bible for these people for throughout the whole of this. So when you said the thing about hips storing emotions, that sort of made me think of this. But I also think that it's not actually the same thing that you're saying, because it's not like you're holding memories in parts of your body, because I don't know how memory exactly would actually be physically manifested in a part of.
The only way that you can hold that kind of thing in your body, as we know now, is just through chemicals.
Right.
You know, everything that you feel, your body goes through. So, like, I don't think people really acknowledge the fact that your emotions can take a toll on your body. So if you're constantly riding, like, an emotional roller coaster, oh, I'm happy, I'm happy, I'm happy, oh, I'm sad, oh, I'm really, really angry. You know, if you're, like, constantly going berserk, you're actually putting a lot of strain on your body, because your liver and your kidneys constantly have to get rid of those chemicals that you no longer decided you're no longer angry anymore. So now that has to be filtered out. You hear that a bit in yoga, that your body stores your events, your things that you go through. And I think that there is some truth in that, but only the same way that, like, if you were a woodworker and you didn't wear gloves, eventually you would get calluses. You know, if you are constantly putting your body through something, your body is going to change. The inside of your body will adapt to the constant stress or the constant ups and down, up and down, up and down, and all these different chemicals and things.
It's almost like looking at the rings of a tree when you cut it down, like seeing where.
Yeah.
You know, like when they grow faster and slower.
And they say, like, oh, it was rainy now and not rainy here. And
yeah, yeah. It's almost like there. That, yeah, rather than exactly. An actual literal memory. It's like an imprint of something that you can create a story if you look back at it, but you couldn't.
And obviously we have to remember that, like, our nervous system and our brain work in tandem together very, very closely and very well. So when we say, like, oh, I feel it, oh, it's like heartache or something, you know, you feel it in your chest. Well, that's just because, you know, the main nerves that come down from the back of the head do wrap around the neck and come down and settle in the chest. And so sometimes when we feel strong emotions, those nerves are sending those signals. And that is why we feel heartache rather than, I don't know, headache. You know, it's not like, oh, something sad has happened, so now I've got a headache. You know, we always describe it as happening in the chest. But that's because there's just that strong connection. And then, like you're saying, that can happen everywhere, and everything that you feel leaves a mark on the body. Some women can end up with painful periods because they've been stressed before the period and stuff like that. And it just struggles to perform well, you know, to get all the stuff going and stuff. And there's, like, loads of knock-on effects of, like, going through stuff, you know.
I can see why people would draw the conclusion, if you had the thesis, that memories were stored in certain parts, because it would map onto exactly what you said.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about how memory works?
Like, in your brain?
Yeah.
Not really, I suppose not. I mean, I suppose they go in your brain. I imagine it's like little files.
Well, like in the film Inside Out?
Yeah, there you go.
I think that relies on a lot of Freudian ideas. I don't think that's necessarily a scientifically watertight conception.
I read something that is along these lines. So I read an article about money beliefs. I'm not backing this up with any science. It was just in, like, one of those kind of newslettery things. And I was like, oh, okay, let's read about that. Anyway, and it said, basically, this person who wrote the article said that she read a book that said, or it was a bit of the book, but they said that you form your money beliefs by the age of 7. So one of the first things you can do if you're struggling with money is to go back and think of what's the first money memory you can remember.
Right.
And what is that shaping in your life? And I thought that sounded very Freudian. I thought that was a bit like...
What's the phrase? Show me the child until the age of whatever and I'll show you the man or something.
Yeah. But she was saying, like, if you want to change it, you know, try to find, you know, these kind of old core beliefs or whatever, which to some extent is true. Obviously, you're influenced by how your parents feel about money and how you grew up and things like that.
Yeah, but also genetically, you probably have the same... Like, people think, oh, I got the same opinions as my parents because they brought me up the same way, but it's probably because you're genetically the same stock anyway, isn't it? I mean, it's like
could
you have
be.
A,
yeah.
Or it's certainly something that, I don't know, we don't like to think about that so much because we, I think, like to think that we have more control over how someone will turn out. If you're a parent, for example, and your kids turn out all right, you like to think that it was because you did a good job and not just because they had the particular genes for, you know, not being a delinquent or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not saying
it's... Is that part of the nature-nurture debate then?
Yeah, it is. And it's like people that think that... It's like Marx, in a way, thought that if you changed society, then you would change human beings and the way they thought. But that's like, you're not going to be able to eradicate a lot of what is evolutionary human nature of however many billion year old organism. Can't just like, yeah. it's not that it has no effect. It's just, but you can't like completely reshape what a human being is by just, you know, killing a load of kulaks or whatever.
That's true. That's very true.
But we want to be able to think that we can do that because we're human beings that, you know, want to be change agents and stuff.
Mm.
If you say that stuff is genetic, then it takes away the agency.
Just because something is genetic doesn't mean that, like, that's that and there's nothing...
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean it's predetermined, but I mean it's just the ingredients for a thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
You're in a culture environment where certain genetic dispositions either get turned on or just don't ever get interacted with. Mm. If you've got a genetic predisposition to being alcoholic, which is possible, I mean, things don't get narrowed down to one gene anyway, do they, very often? Tell me if I'm talking nonsense, but I'm sure it's only things like... When they look at genetic predispositions to certain things, it's very hard to isolate just one gene for things, unless it's things like Huntington's, I think you can isolate the gene for that.
Right, yeah.
But I think you couldn't say, here is the... lung cancer gene or the testicular cancer gene and stuff. It would,
yeah.
I think it'd be more complicated than just one. But again, I don't, this is like, I'm a rudimentary explorer of this sort of thing. But if you had the genetic predisposition to alcoholism, which may well, something akin to that might run in families, a higher possibility of being addicted to, and even not, but if you live in a society where there's zero alcohol, that's never going to get turned on. So similarly, the culture will affect whether certain things are interacted with in a genetic code of a person's behaviours. So it's got no effect. But why did I start talking about this? I was trying to talk about memory and I can't remember why. I can't remember.
You can't remember. That's a problem.
I mean, I did read that Robert Sapolsky book. I'm sure there was some discussion of how memories are actually stored in a... I'm sure he had something in there about how it's sort of technically stored in someone's brain somehow, because it must be it must literally be there in some sort of physical form somehow.
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it?
If it's inside a material being, there must be some... But then memory is not reliable either, is it? Because you reframe memories over time, and then if you tell the story, it takes a different significance. Don't yawn.
Sorry. I was hoping you wouldn't notice, but...
No.
It's not that I'm yawning at you, I'm just yawning.
I know memory is unreliable because you reframe a lot of memories when you tell it. And also, I mean, I know I'll do this, like, you embellish a story to make it slightly better when you retell it as well.
Yeah.
So then, that'll assume what you actually think that actually happened, because you just slightly changed one thing to make the ending better or something. And then,
that
becomes the memory.
And also, I think, like, you start to put, like, you can put rose-tinted glasses on things as well. So, like, if you look back and think, oh, I had a great childhood, then all of a sudden you had a great childhood, and everything that, all these bad things you remember, they weren't that bad, you know, because you decided you had a great childhood or whatever it was, you know. So there's definitely, like, our memories aren't, they aren't, you know, zeros and ones, you know. It's not, it's not clear cut like that. They're malleable based on how we develop and grow and decide things as a person.
But sometimes you realize, like, I mean, I guess it's like when Me Too happened and people could look back and reevaluate certain relations or incidents they'd had with men and realize that something was actually more inappropriate than it may have felt at the time, because especially if it's like a power or a dynamic, or like someone's like much older and you're younger and you don't realize you were being taken advantage of, perhaps in a certain way, that you, so your memory of something might have been somewhat innocuous, you haven't really thought about it for years, and then when this new reframing comes along, you sort of suddenly reframe it as actually quite a traumatic and inappropriate thing.
But I would say that, like, reframing it into something traumatic if it wasn't traumatic before, you made a choice to give yourself a problem. So I struggle with, I'm not saying that you can't look back on it and decide it was bad or not appropriate, but to go as far as to say, like, now I'm traumatized by it. It's like, we weren't traumatized by it yesterday, so...
Don't victim blame.
No, I'm just saying, like, if you were genuinely okay with it yesterday, then...
Yeah.
Then you're genuinely okay with it. I mean, you can make... Everybody makes mistakes. I'm not saying it wasn't, like, a problem. Or it shouldn't have happened or something like that. But I just mean, like, if you felt... Because trauma is always relevant to the person. It's not a defined thing. There's not a certain amount of something you have to go through before you can class it as trauma. So if someone has gone their whole life and has not felt that it was traumatic, and then they see something and then they decide that it wasn't right, and then the more they think about it, the more they get, you know, trauma by it. I'm not saying that you can't reassess things, but I think it's okay to identify that something maybe should have been traumatic, but you don't feel that way.
No,
like, obviously, as long as you're not lying to yourself. But I think in terms of, like, looking at old events with new light, if you weren't bothered then it's okay to not be bothered now, but still recognize that it was, recognize in a different mindset that it wasn't right.
Yeah, no, I think that's okay. I think that makes it sound all right.
Thanks. So are we talking about the hip, or have we completely moved on now?
Well, we started talking about the hip, so we'll go back to, I think it's the only bit of anatomy I haven't talked about. And I mean, you're not going to talk about, like, the ear and the nose and...
Probably not.
You don't really do yoga for the ears.
No, the ear is quite interesting. Did you know you have ear stones?
No, you don't mean the bones in your ear, do you?
They're these little tiny stones that are in your ear. They're a bone. And they sit in a little cup. And they help you decide which way your head is up. And if they detach and fall out, that's when you get, like proper dizziness. Vertigo. So ears aren't as boring as you might think.
No, I wasn't saying they're boring. I was saying you can't...
I feel like it's a challenge. Are you going to tell me I can't talk about it?
No, of course you can. You know,
for a whole episode.
No, ears are, very... Yeah, right.
I have a skill. I can talk about anything. I've probably inherited it from my mother.
You have, yeah. It's nothing to do with learning. It's all just, like, baked in.
Yep, baked in.
So you look at twin studies. That's true. That's where they measure a load of this stuff, like twin studies. And twins are raised by biological parents and, like, or adopted parents and stuff, and they turn out to be pretty much have the same interests and things, and outcomes are very similar. Also, just, like, sorry to go, I've just completely gone backwards with the hips, but I just remembered, in terms of, like, opinions and stuff like that, I think there's arguments to be made that people that have certain mindsets from an early... That's it, because you said about from the age of 7 about your opinions on money.
Yes, that was it.
And I was going to say that I read Jonathan Haidt's book a while back about how people have different political opinions based on their moral codes, which he sort of tracks back to being more inherent attitudes towards certain things, basically. So people of a certain political persuasion have a moral code based on their attributes more so than, like, it's not because the evil the Daily Mail has corrupted them and stuff like that. People genuinely have a dispensation to certain ways of thinking morally that leads them to thinking differently politically. And I think that's a very healthy way to look at it, because that's much more healthy than saying half the population are bad people that are stupid. I mean...
That's quite an easy thing to say, though, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think most vocal people seem to say stuff like that, but they're probably, I think people just get, in the internet world, it's just, it's quite easy to gravitate towards those things, because you're probably getting, you know, wound up in certain areas and you're getting reinforced in certain areas, and it just, like, creates that kind of to and fro. But I think it's a much healthier way to think about why people think certain things in that sense, rather than thinking, well, they just think that because they're bigoted, but they don't know that. And people genuinely, like, left-wing people genuinely think right-wing people think right-wing things because they're selfish and stupid. And, like, I'm not saying there's absolutely none of that out there. Like, you can always find bigoted racist people that don't want to pay any tax and stuff, but but, like, I don't know, I want to think more of people than just that, you know.
I mean, in the end, I suppose we're all human. We're not usually black and white like that, you know. We've got gray areas to how we feel and stuff, and the people who are, like, who do come across that way probably just, like, are trying to adopt a persona or an idea or something, especially if they're really vocal on like podcasts and stuff. It's like, oh well, I'm this guy, I've got to say it. So
yeah, you're a brand, aren't you? That's how you become successful now, is you become a brand. So you're the guy that says that sort of thing. Or
exactly, when really that's very unrealistic, because as humans we should and do change our mind on the same things like a lot, and it's okay. Maybe we not should on do all your core values, but on topics of interest,
like as your life priorities change, you realize why certain people might think something that you didn't think 10 years ago before you had kids. I think having kids changes people's perspective on loads of these things from the start. But because if you've ever expressed an opinion on the internet, so if you write something 10 years ago, like all some sort of people are scum or whatever, and then in 10 years time you start thinking slightly differently and you express that, someone will find the thing from 10 years ago and do a this you thing. So if it's kind of, I don't think that living in an internet space is particularly good for people reevaluating things, because you're more accountable to your written thoughts that you've had, whereas like in the past you just think something and there wouldn't be a direct record of anything that you were thinking 10 years ago, so you wouldn't be bound to it in such a way that it's harder to maybe reevaluate, because you become either a traitor or you save face or you look like someone that's not hypocrite. I mean, 10 years you shouldn't look like a hypocrite, but in some ways you almost do look like someone that has been indecisive, or like, you know, flown with the wind or whatever. Like,
and the other thing as well is you don't know in what way it's being saved or going out there. It may be looking, it might not be as obvious to see the time change or the how long and things like that as well. Obviously, if you're just doing a post on like Twitter or whatever, then people will be able to see that it's old, and vice versa. It's like when you see someone who you know really well in the old films in like the 80s, and then you see them now and you're like, whoa, like they're allowed to age. It happens. But obviously, if you're used to them looking a different way, it kind of catches you off guard, doesn't it? It's kind of like that. You know, people are allowed to change. But if you're not expecting it, then you might be like, what's this going on? You know.
So, the hips.
Okay, back to the hips. I was speaking to one of my doctor students recently, my medical doctor students, and she was creating a course for new doctors to teach them. As she was creating this course, anything that she stated, she had to back up with hard research, obviously. All research that you have to do at, you know, uni level and above needs to have references on it and stuff.
That's why nothing that gets produced by a university is ever wrong.
Anyway, she had started writing it, and obviously she wrote it, I'm going to say from the heart, that sounds a bit mushy, but she wrote it from her memory, from what she'd been doing over the years, you know, she was, you know, from her experience. And then when she tried to back some of it up, she found she was wrong.
Right.
And it was a bit of a blow. And she was like, oh, you know, I've had to rethink things and take a bit of the, you know, I've been wrong with this, you know? How long have I been wrong with that? You know, so it happens. So I do try to fact check what I say. I don't just read it once and then never check it again, because in the end, when it comes to medical things especially, it does change over time. There was a really long belief for a long time that you couldn't grow your brain back, that once it was damaged, it was forever gone. That is not the case. It's also been believed that you can't grow neurons in your body. Like, you, once you lose feeling in something, you wouldn't get it back. It's very unlikely that you get full feeling back in limbs and things if it was like a proper chunk gone. But in terms of individual neurons growing, yes, they do. They do grow back when they die. So that is proven to be wrong as well. So you have to keep an eye on these things, I'm saying. So I do try to fact check. But basically, when we're talking about the hips, I know we mentioned about like storing chemicals in the tissues of the body, and then when those tissues get damaged or ripped or whatever, that chemical is then released. So basically that can happen very easily in the hip, in a way, if you want to say that that's true, because the hip is just so wrapped up in so much. So you've got all of the connective tissues, all of the muscle, everything is really stuck together really tightly. So it's a very stable joint. I mean, there are not many people that have dislocated their hip. Car accidents, extreme force is basically required to really damage the hip like that, to dislocate it. But basically what we tend to want to do is obviously get it a bit more open and flexible. So usually when people come to yoga classes for hips, they're like, oh, just, I want to, you know, my hips are so tight, I can't move, I can't sit, you know, those kind of things. So we want to get rid of that feeling of like kind of glued together. We want to create mobility in the hip. But one of the physical problems that come with stretching and opening through the hips is the joints along the way. So when we try to stretch the hip, the knee is going to take it first. So you have to find either positions that don't require the knees to be in anything special, or you have to just be very mindful of the knee as you try to get your way to the hip. So that could be, you know, wrapping it up. That could be not, you know, so for example, pigeon pose is a really common yoga pose, but that twists the knee that ends up under the chest. So if you can't do that because that knee is like in agony, or even if you just feel like it's quite a deep stretch in your knee, or you feel sensation in the, under the kneecap, then you don't want to be doing it because it's not going to be, even if it's giving you a lovely stretch in your hip, it's going to be hurting your knee. So there's a bit of that from like the physical side of things. But then maybe I think a little bit could also be like, why are we bothered? Maybe like, why do we want to have flexible hips?
I was going to ask that question.
Ah, good.
You should have let me ask that question so it didn't look like you just talking for 5 minutes.
But
No.
You can ask it and then clip it in.
So why would you want to become more flexible with your hips? I mean, why?
Well, that's a really good question. Okay, so I do think it is important that like we do assess why we want things. So I have had people come to me and say, like, oh, I want to get into a split. I'm going to teach you how to get into a split. I have no idea what's going on inside your hip bones. Some hips, I'll try and explain this for our listeners. Some hips sit very deep in the socket of the hip itself, of the pelvis. So if you make a fist with your hand, you wrap your other hand around it. Some of them are very deep. You can like really tighten. And some hips, the femur, the top of the femur bone just rests almost like it's resting in like a dish, a plate or something, rather than wrapping around. So this is bone, obviously, not anything to do with tendon, just bone. So depending on how deep your hip is, depending on what's going on with the actual skeletal structure, you may never be able to do a split. And that has nothing to do with, you know, getting yourself flexible or just giving it a go or trying harder. If your bones are hitting bone, it's not going to move anymore. And you're just going to start damaging all the stuff that softens the joint, you know, all the cushioning.
You can't do splits, can you?
No, I can't. No. And I don't think I ever will, to be honest. But I do think in terms of like the why, there is some kind of thought process behind the idea of flexibility, allowing things to move freely through the body. So if you like clench your fist, you can clench your fist, that's fine. But if you clenched your fist for hours, that would not be good. Like you can see parts of the fist that go white because the fist is clenched and blood isn't flowing freely. So it's a similar kind of thing with flexibility in the body. So if your hips are really, really tight and you feel really restricted mobility in your hips, then starting to do movements to open and stretch and get some of the connective tissue to snap. So not all of them, obviously, not your tendons, but like fascia and build up and stuff like that. And you get maybe even deep massages, but I would be mindful unless you've had x-rays and stuff and what's going on. I wouldn't necessarily go into external force. I would always just do it yourself. And it can take time. You know, if you're wanting to have super flexible hips and you started out not being able to sit cross-legged on a floor because it's just so uncomfortable, you're looking at years. You know, it should be a slow process. It's not going to happen quickly. It's going to happen over 2 years, maybe 1 year. If you practice 2 times a week on a regular basis, you probably see a big difference after 1 year. But it does take a lot of time and it should be slow because that's, if it's fast, that's what we call injury. Mm-hmm. You know, so it needs to be slow. But then once you get that kind of mobility and you get rid of that tightness, then things do flow more freely. You might have less pain in your butt. You might have less like sciatica pain or pinchy pains or nerve pains. Feet might never go numb. You know, like if you cross your legs and your feet go numb, it can be because things are pinched. So if you get more and more used to it, you're more and more flexible, you'll be able to one day, sometimes, obviously there's exceptions to every rule or whatever, but you would say sometimes you would be able to cross your feet and then not go numb then. So It's about kind of creating that free flow, not just blood, but all the fluid and all the signals, including nerve signals. So it is quite important to some extent. And obviously it depends on what life you live and stuff like that and what you plan to do.
Okay.
So there you go.
Well, it's been nice talking to you.
I'm just jabbering for the whole podcast.
No, it's fine.
It's a it's frustrating, but if you go to a studio, what they tend to have is props. So I wouldn't let it put you off, basically. If you're listening and you think like, oh, I've got really tight hips, I can't sit on the floor, I'll never be able to do yoga. They usually, if you go to the studio and you talk to the yoga teacher, you say, I can't sit on the floor because my hips just really don't like it. So he, she will probably give you a bolster to sit on, some blocks. A good yoga teacher will assist you throughout the class and maybe even just change the whole practice they had planned so that you can participate. That I always tailor my classes to who's there. And if I look around and go, ooh, then out we come and we don't do anything like that through the rest of the class, you know. And it happens every now and then where you're like, oh, that did not look right. Okay, we won't do that again. We won't do that anymore. So if you have done something and then you've been put off by it, try again.
So I have a question. So having done this for like 5 years, I'm at my max now then, you think, in terms of flexibility? Like stuff that isn't already happening is not going to happen.
The only thing that I keep thinking about is your knees. I feel like we could be able to get your knees straighter in some of the poses with more time. Yeah, but I don't know.
All right, where's this criticism suddenly come out from?
No, it's not criticism. It's not a criticism. I just think like, because you're saying 5 years is a long time. Yeah. And so I would have thought that your hamstrings and your lower back are probably at a good flexibility. So the issue with your knees being bent in, say, your forward fold or as you reach for your toes, I wonder where that stems from. Like, I want to know. Is that something else? Is that something I could have worked on more? Is there something I'm missing?
Yeah, it was your failing, not mine, you see.
Yeah, it's on me, definitely. But normally I would say like after a year of regular practice, after 5 years, absolutely you'd be at a very strong place. So there's a chance that maybe I'm not pushing you hard enough, or maybe something could be different that would change your body. Oh, that's all I mean. It's like yes and no when you think about like, oh, should I be at my maximum after 5 years? Yes and no. And you have only been practicing with me. So maybe if you went to a rocket yoga class for a year, they'd get you into shape. I don't know.
Time in it, just all time, you know. I mean, it's whizzing by, quarter of the year's gone already.
Don't say that. No, you're right.
And it's the long part of the year as well, where it's dark and horrible. So it's like a pendulum swing. It's like slowly gets to this time, and then it goes whoosh through the like
whoosh through the
rest
the summer,
of it.
And then back to winter again.
That's how time works on a like how it feels like it works, your perception of it and stuff, which I've never really understood why it seems to go quicker.
It can work like that, but we're in nearly circular orbits, so probably not so much.
What do you mean?
Well, our orbits aren't technically exactly circular, so at some point when we're closest to the sun, we do go a little bit faster.
Oh, so you mean because it was elliptic? I know the lingo. I know.
So if we were in a highly elliptical orbit, it would make a massive difference. Like that would go really quickly, and then that would go slowly, and then that would go really quickly. But obviously, we're basically in a circular orbit, so it probably isn't. Yeah, I would have to look up how perceivable that change actually is. If it's just like what, a few seconds or something, I don't know.
Well, that just meant with age, because it's supposed to time speeds up as you get older. They say, don't they? So.
Oh yeah, that too. That's because that's all based on your memories. Did you know that?
No, but please explain, because that's a lovely turning around. That could be a great thing to close on, because it loops back to the start.
I'll say so basically I'll put it extremely simply, because I won't pretend to know the science behind it all, but basically they say because we have lived more than we lived when we were a child, there's less new things being added to our memory bank. And so we are perceiving it as like, when's the next new thing? When's the next thing? Oh, that's a new thing. And then we register it. When's the next new thing? Oh, that's a new thing. So the time in between new things goes faster until you get another new thing. So when you're a child, everything's new. Time is going really slow. When you're an adult, over years, I'm saying, obviously not like minutes and days, but years, time is going slower because you're having less new experiences, which is why some people like hunger for them. They want to like travel the world and constantly see new things and stuff. It's because it's a way.
Well, and that genuinely makes a difference. If you do more things as an adult, you have more new experiences. That will genuinely make. Because I don't believe that.
They say that the more new, the fact that you're having less new experiences makes time feel like it's going faster. Like makes a year feel like it went fast. I think that's one of the reasons why, like all the lockdowns.
Where are you measuring from the perception?
From the perception of the individual. So you're talking like psychology rather than like physiology.
So when I'm perceiving that time's going quicker, is that me getting to the end of the year and going, bloody hell, where did that go? And then not being able to collate enough new experiences in the last 12 months to make it feel like it's gone quicker than when I was a kid.
Fear.
Is that how, that's how it
idea.
Works, right?
Yeah.
You're not downplaying experience itself. Because I read different... I'm always reading a book. Like, so what's the difference between a notable experience? Like, I'm still living and experiencing things.
Well, you
I'm
know still how ex- we talked about those little core memories from Inside Out.
Yeah, yeah.
The book just wasn't gold. Sorry.
Right.
No, you're right. You're right. Like, what classes does it? I don't know. Maybe it has to be something more thrilling. I don't know. As a child, everything's interesting. Well,
this
everything's
just seems
new.
Like a... I'm not buying this. I'm
you're not,
not
buying it.
No, I'm not. I think
well,
it's
maybe
just...
this is one of those old theories that have been debunked now that I should fact check.
I think I've heard this theory before, but I just think that you're adding to cumulative experience anyway, and I think that you just have... The last year of your life is a smaller percentage of what the year before was of your life. So, isn't it? Because you've added to the number of, so every year is less of a percentage of your whole life in total. So that is that where the
Wouldn't
perception
that only
is?
Be the case if you were past middle age of your age? Does that make sense?
It just means you're because you're still alive.
Yeah, but so, you don't know how long you're going to live, so you can't say that you're
No. No, because you're looking back at it now. So, okay, so now I'm 39. So, now I wish I'd have been around a number so I could have bloody done this easier. Okay. But, okay, so say I'm 50, right?
Okay.
Then, and I'm looking back at the last 50 years of my life. The previous year of my life would have been 2% of my life, right?
Oh, okay.
But the year before, the previous year of my life would have been between 2 and 3% or whatever. So every time I'm measuring it...
Oh, because you're making the... container bigger. Yes.
My perception of how quickly the year has gone is I feel like it's more feasible to say it's because it's less of a percentage of my total life experience rather than the nature of the experiences that I've had during that year.
Is that really that much different?
Yeah, but you could say, because it's a similar bracketed thing to me. So in your 30s, you feel like time is going quicker than it did in your 20s. So it's just like, do you know what I mean? And I even remember being a teenager thinking, oh, wow, the school holiday's here again and it had gone quicker than... So to me, that's why perception would change, not the... So I thought, oh, fuck this. I'm fed up with time going too quickly. I'm going to have a year off work. I'm going to spend all my money. I'm going to, like, go to all these different countries and have these amazing experiences and stuff.
Yeah.
That's not going to slow the year down.
Maybe not.
Time flies when you're having fun as well. So
yeah,
what are you going to do?
To
have a
load
of unique experiences that are horrible. So I'm going to go and have some colonoscopies every day or something.
Yeah, if you have horrible experiences, then maybe you have to have a year of horrendous experiences.
I'm going to a funeral a day or something.
No, because you're right in the fact that, like, when you're really enjoying yourself, like, time does seem to go quicker. Like, that moment passes quicker. But then if you were constantly filling a year with things, like those two things clash, don't they?
Yeah.
And those two ideas clash. Time flies when you're having fun, plus the idea that more experiences make time slow down. More new experiences make time slow down.
But then there could still be something to it. Like, I mean, like, if you think of the lockdowns, I reckon towards the end of lockdown, you could be perceiving time as going quicker because you're much used to a newer situation rather than the initial sort
or
of,
or the fact,
like,
that everything just blended into one day. What day is it? It's March. It's the day of March. Well, there you go. Anybody listening, if you go out and have a berserk year, let us know and we will
Did
invite
it slow
you on
anything
to the next
down?
Show.
So, yeah. Speaking of time flying, wow, what a, this has just like gone whiz by, isn't it? So.
Yeah, it has. We should probably finish. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed our discussion and all the things we talk about. If you have any thoughts on it, I would love to hear them. If you have any topics you want us to talk about or discuss that we haven't done yet, then reach out and let us know. I hope you enjoyed the show.
And all the links for all our things are in the show description, so just make sure you follow us, subscribe, tell your friends.
Yes.
Because we'd like more listeners to be good. So anyway, right. Bye.